Welcome to Dumb Question. I'm your host, Kent McKay, and I know a lot of interesting people. I bring them on, and I ask them dumb questions. In this episode, part two of my interview with Bill Gibson, we talk about Shakespeare, the paleo diet, and have some advice for aspiring young scientists. This is part two of Dumb Questions Talk with Bill Gibson. Which I'll probably cut from the podcast because it's really trivial. I've always seen when people do the swabbing in petri dishes, there's a certain pattern done. Why? What is the deal with that? Can you speak to that? It's like you do it a certain way and you cross it, and it's a very specific pattern I always see when they do those petri dish swabs.
It depends on the experiment you're doing. If I reach back into the depths of my hippocampus for my microbiology training, often you just want to spread the cells out very, very evenly onto the and look for individual colonies. So if you want the bacteria, a small amount of bacteria on your loop, and each one to grow into an individual colony, you don't want them all bunched up in one area. Mm. So that's why you streak from side to side and then go perpendicular. In other situations, you might say divide the plate into quarters and streak four different types of bacteria, one on each quarter. So usually you find that the first streak has lots of bacteria, and then a lot of those colonies grow together and stick together, whereas later on in the streaking that you do, you get nice individual colonies that you can pick. So it's about separating the individual bacteria so that you know all of their offspring have come from one bacterium as opposed to a blob.
Hmm. It's just interesting because, like, even as unexperienced with biology as I clearly am, that image is almost iconic when they show someone doing science in a lab. They'll show the little petri dish, and it's got a very specific pattern.
And yet, the clever observation that led to that dumb question is that you actually noticed that there was a specific pattern to the way they do that. So that's something else that I would say to an aspiring young scientist is really think about what you observe in the world, because observations are the critical thing for science.
So, as a personal question, what are you reading right now?
Believe it or not, I am reading Twelfth Night by William Shakespeare, and I don't say that just to sound erudite on air. I really love the Bard on the Beach Shakespeare Festival in Vancouver, and I'm enough of a Shakespeare nerd that every year I try to read through each play before I go to see it.
Okay.
So I kind of get more out of it, and so that's what I'm reading right now. The fiction that I'm reading is Twelfth Night.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I'm working through Hamlet right now.
Yes, I understand you have an upcoming show.
We do have an upcoming show, which will probably be long gone by the time this podcast drops. So I may or may not plug it in the show notes.
Okay,
but,
understood.
I've always had a hard time reading Shakespeare. Like, it always seems very... It's meant to be spoken, right?
So yes.
When you read, do you ever like read it out loud to yourself or to your wife or kids as you're reading it? Or can you, you know, just read it silently and pitch the voices in your head kind of thing?
I often read in bed, so I don't read out loud to my wife because that would wake her up. So
she's got her own book.
Since I wish my wife to continue to be my wife, I do my best not to wake her up by reading Shakespeare aloud.
Yeah, just because I've heard a lot of people talk about that. Like, they try to read the play and it's like it kind of falls flat. But you speak it out loud, some of these words, it's all about the words, right?
Yes.
And have them actually come out suddenly makes much more sense.
I guess I read it realizing that I won't understand everything on the page, and then allow the actors who are actually performing it to inform my understanding. So when I read through the play, I look at that as laying down the mortar, and then the actors actually put the real brick on top. They're doing the hard work. I'm just getting my mind ready to receive their performance.
That's good, doing your homework, as it were. Well, yes. I was thinking it was interesting about modern productions of Shakespeare will, you know, will cut a lot of, have to cut a lot of lines and maybe modernize it a little bit and set it in a different time, maybe a modern time. And maybe because they don't trust the audience. They don't expect everyone to be someone who reads the play before going to the show. And I was thinking, well, Shakespeare's audience didn't study Shakespeare in school.
That's true. They probably didn't.
They probably weren't even mostly literate.
Right.
And yet, you know, they showed up and got the gist of the play. Well, I can guarantee everyone in, you know, the audience of, you know, The Bard on the Beach studied Shakespeare in high school.
Probably is. Right. Yes.
So maybe not that particular play, but they have, you know, read something, they've heard something about it, and yet we, at the same time, a lot of directors maybe don't trust the audience to, like, come along with them. And I think it's an interesting...
Well, certainly, they didn't call it that back... they didn't call them Easter eggs back when I was reading Shakespeare in high school, but he did put in multi-layers to the text and jokes that some component of the audience might get, and lots of, I guess, time-specific puns. So he did make it an excellent use of Easter eggs to make sure that his audience, high and low social status, would everyone would get something out of the play.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I find that, I'm sure that as people were, like you say, like, the groundlings were getting a certain, they like the sword fights and they like the kissing, and then the people in the back going, ha ha, he referenced Plato.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. I try to get read out loud with my wife, and she's always hears me in the other room, and she thinks I'm just talking to myself. It's like, are you okay in there? And I'm just running lines. Leave me. It's okay. We're good. So earlier you mentioned about some people have. There's obviously in the human DNA. There's a newer evolutionary things, like the ability to digest dairy, for instance. As I understand it, is a fairly recent addition to the human condition. Is that a true statement?
I suppose it depends on how you characterize recent. Certainly, cultures that traditionally have relied on cow's milk or milk from other mammals like goats as a major source of calories and protein in the diet, those populations traditionally retain the ability to digest lactose into adulthood. So essentially, just about everyone is born with the ability to digest lactose because they can digest their mother's milk from breastfeeding. Mm. This biological / biochemical trait can disappear later on in life if milk is no longer consumed. But populations like European populations or the Maasai in East Africa that have traditionally relied on milk have retained this trait, and there's research out there that has looked at genetic variants that seem to be strongly associated with the retention of the ability to digest the lactose from milk long term.
Yeah, because I've just heard it explained that this is like in measured in like tens of thousands of years versus, you know, earlier other traits that human traits that are, you know, conceivably much longer. So that what I mean by the earlier.
Yes, I'm afraid I'm not as my knowledge of population genetics is not detailed enough that I put a hard number on it. But we're talking in the small numbers of thousands of years.
Yes. Because there's some trends lately in diet, so like the paleo diet, for instance, that basically take the thought, as I understand it, that we were not meant to digest grains and dairy. They're primarily we were to eat milk and leafy greens. Sorry, meat and leafy greens, based on some sort of both genetic and sociological background. Is there any merit to this claim, or is this something?
There's certainly merit to thinking in detail about what someone eats.
If I can
make a generic motherhood statement, thinking in detail about what you eat is a good thing.
Yes.
With the number of diets that are marketed to the public, there's often a real excess of hype over strong scientific evidence. So certainly there is emerging evidence that a diet high in carbohydrates, particularly refined carbohydrates, is not good for someone's long-term ability to regulate their metabolism. There does seem to be evidence favoring this idea of that high glycemic index foods, and by glycemic index I'm talking about how much insulin and how quickly the body is required to secrete insulin after ingesting a particular meal or eating something, foods that force the body to secrete lots of insulin in a very short period of time can lead to an accumulation of fat and, over the long term, a resistance of the body to the effects of insulin. And that's a known risk factor. Insulin resistance is a known risk factor on the path to diabetes. And there's a huge and recent increase not only in the population prevalence of obesity, and being overweight, but also type 2 diabetes, which is a disease that's very highly correlated with being overweight. So to advertise a particular diet over another, or to sort out the differences between diets actually takes quite a lot of experimental validation, because most humans are free living and eat whatever they want, and it's very difficult to control someone's access to a diet. Certainly some recent papers in the New England Journal of Medicine have presented strong evidence that a Mediterranean diet, which is relatively high in leafy vegetables, with some meat but not excessive amounts of meat, and relatively low in baked goods and refined carbohydrates, is protective against cardiovascular disease. That's a separate marker, though related to the diets that cause or are correlated with diabetes or obesity. But I think we're starting to accumulate really solid evidence. There was another paper recently in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages, so soft drinks largely, but also, you know, double-tall lattes with extra flavor squirts. And
thank you for not using any brand names in that list. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's not your first time.
So there may be a time yet when someone can go into a cafe and order a bacon double cheese latte, but hopefully that time is not soon in the future. Nonetheless, that having a lot of refined sugar, particularly like when you drink it, that kind of does an end run around the body's ability to feel full. And it has been shown that basically the more sugary drinks you drink, the heavier you'll get over time. Mm-hmm. And they also showed...
Just calorie per calorie. That's glycemic index versus high versus low, right?
Well, yes, but this study had a retrospective component to it, meaning looking backwards. It wasn't taking someone at a base and following them through the study.
We can't put everyone in the Skinner box.
Right. but certainly the sugary drinks have a high glycemic index. You get a big whack of sugar right away, and your body has to secrete insulin right away to transfer that sugar into your cells. There was a genetic component to that study, and they found that people who had more... minor genes or common variants that might predispose them to obesity, if you had more of those genes and you drank more sugary drinks, you got even heavier. So there was a gene environment interaction with pretty solid evidence behind it for that. So I think we are really accumulating evidence that high sugar foods are really bad for you. And I know that doesn't sound like a particularly profound scientific revelation.
I think too many people, even I, who do enjoy a sugary drink, am not fooled by its health, any health claims it may make. The recent turn against people, grains especially, I thought unusual, because my understanding of human culture is that when we could stop hunter-gatherer, we start planting roots and literally planting roots and becoming an agrarian-based community is when we suddenly mathematics and philosophy and science and engineering all take off, because we can stop and take our time to do that sort of thing. But I can kind of imagine like the first guy to say, hey, buddy, you don't need to go out hunting today. We have grain. We can stop and have a community here. Somebody went, I don't know, man, carbs. I don't know, gluten, is it low gluten thing? It's like, it's wheat. I planted wheat. It's like, I invented agriculture. Is that not enough for you? I don't know, wheat belly, man. I'm sure there was some primitive early human cult conversation.
Yes, perhaps it's recorded on a Neolithic cave wall somewhere.
Some guy pointing to the grain going, yes. I don't know, some raw vegan. So I'm going to ask this question. I fully expect you to refuse to answer it, but understand. Is there a genetic marker or predisposition for homosexuality?
That is very much not known. I would say that is one of the most interesting, not yet solved biological questions. So we really don't have good evidence either way.
Because I knew there's some basic twin studies, that sort of thing, which is as close as we can get to going, well, these people are genetically identical or similar, and comparing their sexual preference and that sort of thing. But that's interesting. That's still kind of a big question in the realm of science.
Yes, I mean it's not clear at what level that would operate. Presumably at a neurological level, but whether the relative contribution of genetic background to the environment, however you want to define it, someone's experiences through life in determining that kind of preference is very hard to separate out into testable categories. So it's that's probably the reason why it hasn't been solved yet. Certainly there was a lot of enthusiasm around solving the genetics of partner preference in the early days of sequencing and doing linkage analyses and so forth. None of those studies that thought they had found a gene for homosexuality were actually well replicated. So we really still don't know about that.
Does that also tie back into the disease model for genetic study, that if homosexuality is not a disease, then no one's really going to be studying it?
I would say that if it depends on how you define a trait, right? Is something a disease or isn't it? And often it can be easy to find something as a disease if there's an organism invading the body and it makes someone feel terrible and kills them, then that's pretty unambiguously a disease.
Yes.
If it's a style of thinking, that gets into a, if you'll pardon the pun, more of a gray area of the brain. And it can just be hard to set up studies that answer the question unambiguously. Mm-hmm. So certainly there have been in the past genes that were thought to be the homosexuality gene, but further study has shown that that was not reproducible. Mm-hmm. So there is not one or even a few genes known that would cause that.
Hmm. All right. Well, I'm glad you could actually answer that, because it was like one of those outstanding issues that the basic psychology that I took in university was like, well, there's probably a genetic component and there's a sociological component and a learning component, that sort of thing. I was always kind of curious about the genetic, because, you know,
I would say the most likely thing is that all of those components do operate, but the challenge then becomes sorting out the quantitative contribution of each of them. And interestingly, the quantitative contribution of each of those components, the sociological component, the genetic component, the environmental component, those may be different for different people.
So science doesn't have all the answers, is what you're
saying. If science had all the answers, we'd be out of a job.
We'd be done, and we can go read Shakespeare for the rest of the day.
Yes, indeed.
So we can change gears a bit, and we may do a break. We'll see how that goes. If you were willing to talk about fandom and sci-fi for a little bit, if that's...
Sure, happy to talk about fandom.
Cool. So Bill, you're here in Calgary. In part, you attended the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo.
Yes, it was lots of fun.
So what was your seed, if you will, for fandom? The young Bill at home, what got you... What was your first fandom, that you could say?
Difficult to go back that far, sort of first fandom. I mean, I always remember being interested in science fiction. Of course, Star Wars came around at just the right time. when I was, I guess I was 8. Shortly, at the time, my family was living in Edmonton. I believe I saw Star Wars in Edmonton. Shortly after, we moved to Toronto, where I saw my first ever episode of Doctor Who, featuring John Pertwee as the Doctor. And I remember there was a cliffhanger episode from the the Sea Devils, and I was absolutely astonished that they would end the show without telling me what it was, like what happened. As a little kid, I hadn't fathomed the concept of the serial and having the cliffhanger, and it was so I felt truly betrayed at the time, and yet I had to know the answer. So eventually, by going through the TV guide, I figured out that the show was called Doctor Who, but by then they were in a different episode, a different series. But I started watching it, and eventually was able to find out how he survived that particular trial. Yeah.
That's cool, because I think what I remember watching Doctor Who, obviously not first run, it was rerun, and catching in the middle of some serial and being thrown, having a similar experience, being thrown into the middle of it, and it kind of, as a kid, it's like, I don't know what's going on here. Right. Clearly there's a whole thing, and that kind of put me off of it for a bit, until they actually reran in the 80s.
Sure. They started
the series again, and I could watch kind of the first 12 episodes or so in order. So I wonder how many cliffhangers both engaged young viewers and put off young viewers.
Yes.
It's an interesting writer. From a writer's point of view, it's like, is this cliffhanger helping me?
Yes.
Doctor Who, Star Wars, those are your earliest, maybe, not first, but earliest.
If dinosaurs can be considered a fandom, then I would say that would have to be my first love, because I was always into dinosaurs, and dinosaurs are the gateway to actually a fair bit of science fiction. So reading some, Edgar Rice Burroughs, for example, Tarzan at the Earth's Core, and Pellucidar, and that sort of thing. I found that fascinating. And I don't remember exactly when. I mean, I had always heard that the dinosaurs were extinct.
Yes.
And I don't remember exactly when my mind actually made the flip to think, there's no hidden worlds where they're still surviving, no lost plateaus, and it kind of reminds me, presumably when I, found out about Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny, you may want to take those out of the podcast for your younger viewers.
We have a very mature viewing audience.
I'll revise my answer. I'd probably say dinosaurs were my first fandom.
All right. That's fair. Like, I don't think they get enough cred in the modern, because they're not science fiction. They are fact.
That's right.
Although I was shocked to learn a couple years ago that there's no such thing as a brontosaurus.
That's true.
And hasn't been since the 30s, but I think I was still taught, even when I went to school, that a brontosaurus was a thing, and that kind of threw me, it's a little bit like learning about the Easter Bunny as an adult.
Well, I think about the brontosaurus like, it's almost like a mythical beast now, like you talk about the chimera that has the... What is it? The head of a goat, of a lion, and
tails
of a dragon, right? So, I mean, essentially, the brontosaurus is a chimera. It's the body of an apatosaurus with the head of a camarasaurus. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Your oldest mythical beast.
It was in a museum. How could it be not true?
Well, but that just gets back to the scientific method. When new truths emerge, we change our minds.
At some point, you gotta. Throw those away and carry on. And I know at an individual level that can be very difficult, but I think as a culture, we have to be able to do that more readily than perhaps we already do.
I think in part the whole brontosaurus controversy also speaks to, at some level, the necessity and sometimes making hard choices in presenting science to the public. What I recall reading was that originally, the skeleton of Brontosaurus was displayed without the head because the head hadn't been found.
Yes.
And at one point, one of the curators decided, no one wants to see a skeleton with no head, so we're going to, gosh darn it, we're going to put a head on there. And that was the head they had, so it was actually reasonably close. So to what they thought the head looked like. So that was considered acceptable. But then so many observations were made in descriptions of the Brontosaurus, assuming that it was the actual head, when in fact it was yeah. not.
I mean,
so he sort of, that curator made that tough choice of, do we present it accurately or do we present it palatably in order to engage the interest of the public? So
that's a tough call.
Yeah, I mean, it was a tough position for him to be in.
I mean, it's not like the Brontosaurus, I cannot pronounce the beast that it actually is.
A Apatosaurus,
and other similar ones. They're not that dissimilar from my mental image of a Brontosaurus, so it's not completely revolutionary, but still, you know, or learning that the Triceratops is probably a juvenile form of yet another.
Well, there's some real challenges in paleontology in figuring out which measurements are the most important. So yes, is Triceratops a separate species, or is it a juvenile form of Torosaurus, I think?
Yeah, yeah.
These controversies always erupt in the literature.
And how many... Now they all have feathers, I think.
Which is pretty cool.
Which is pretty cool if you picture them as maybe being more feathered or something that's neither scale nor feather. Probably more accurate.
Well, that's right. And they're even starting to analyze some of the actual fossils from I think it's the Liaoning area of China, where the feathers are reasonably well preserved to get some insight into the actual pigments in the feathers. Although those have not been preserved, I think they can get some idea of the dark and light pigment patterns that the feathers might have had, or proto-feathers. So.
Neat. So this raises a question. The doctor comes to you, the doctor of Doctor Who comes to you, and gives you one trip in time and space. Where do you go?
You know, it probably would have to be the late Cretaceous. Probably would have to just see those dinosaurs, hopefully not too up close, at least not the predatory ones. So yes, that would be my pick. Late Cretaceous.
That's a question that I have wrestled with on many levels. Like, if you could go anywhere in time and space, you know, would you go human history, distant, you know, try to find alien history, because it's all kind of on the table. Or, you know, Late Cretaceous is a good one. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, then you went there, you'd see some dinosaurs, and then you'd be chased by, you know, sea devils for 45 minutes.
Hey, if it was only for 45 minutes, that'd be all right.
As you know, 45 minutes and then an explosion resolution, then you're done. So
yes.
that's knowing wherever you go, you don't necessarily get to do what you thought you were going to do, which is the second layer to the Doctor Who question.
Yes, exactly.
That's good. So would you have a current... big current fandom that you're currently excited about?
I mean, I would say that Doctor Who would probably have to be my current favorite fandom. Again, partly because the series went off the air and then was revived. It's kind of like when they say you can't go home again, and yet it feels like you can when something from your childhood disappears and you're sort of sad for it and mourn its loss, and then they bring it back. So so that would have to be my current favorite. Yes. So and you get reaching back into the days of childhood.
That's good. And you like the current doctor, the Matt Smith?
Yes, absolutely.
So who would be your doctor? Like, would it be...
Well, it would probably be Tom Baker in the sense that was... at that period of time when I basically watched all of the episodes and I didn't watch enough of John Pertwee had sort of was replaced by Tom Baker quite early into my following. Mm-hmm. So Tom Baker is the one, those episodes were what got me hooked on the series. So if it were my doctor, then it would have to be Tom Baker.
That's good. Yeah. But I want to thank you for coming down to the luscious Dumb Question Studios and having a chat with me.
Thanks very much, Kit. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks a lot. For more Dumb Question, go to standupcomic.ca.